My name is Raleigh Sadler. I'm the executive director and founder of Let My People Go. And I'm also currently the executive director of the anti-trafficking program for an organization called One More Child, which is also the Florida Baptist Children's Home. So doing two roles at the same time. And it's interesting because I went to Southern Seminary. I knew and really wanted to be a pastor. My heart is with the local church. You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about the universal church, and a lot of ministries that are focused on what I'm doing are focused on the universal church. And they have this idea of mobilization that I think is incredibly well-meaning, but it's this idea of churches can help us be the practitioners and do the work. And with this local church idea that I can't seem to shake, I can't get around the idea of maybe my job in mobilization is to not get people to pay me to do what I want to do, which, I mean, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We love for people to give to us. That helps. Can't do it without it. But we kind of spin it and say we want to work with the church and help them do the work. Because at the end of the day, human trafficking impacts more than 40 million people around the world. It's cases have been reported in every country and every state. Every community has cases of human trafficking in some way, but like we were talking about earlier, you may not have the eyes to see it or the words to express it. You might just say, oh, well, that's where all the people who are in prostitution go. Or that's where all the immigrants work, the new migrant workers, that's where they are. But we don't think about, you know, how did they get there? How are they paid? Are they paid a fair wage? I was talking with a friend of mine who I met in New York. He used to be on that show called Bar Rescue back in the day. I don't know if you've ever seen that show. It's on Paramount Network. But he was one of the chefs that would go into these bars and restaurants and fix their menu. And Brian Duffy and I were talking, and I was like, you know, oftentimes this can happen in restaurants. I worked in restaurants in Louisville where there were people there, and I'm like, their documentation has to be falsified. Has to be falsified, because this person's 12 years old, but their documentation says 18. But they have to be 12 years old. I'm just looking. And as I was talking to him, and we're just kind of hashing it out, he said, I had a guy, he would bring people to work for me, and he's like, I just have to put butts in seats, basically. I just have to staff positions. And he's like, he would always have people. I said, I need three cooks and one sous chef, and he's like, they would always magically appear. And he goes, could he have been a trafficker? And I said, it's potential. Yes, there's a potential that could be happening. Because here's the deal, you have human trafficking, because human trafficking is an exploitation of vulnerability for commercial gain. So whether it's for sex, labor, domestic servitude, or in other countries, organ trafficking, it's always someone with a little bit more power and status than the person they're exploiting. So can human trafficking happen at the Super Bowl? 100% it can happen at the Super Bowl. But it happens at the Super Bowl because there are people. It happens wherever there are people and wherever there is a drive or desire to get a service. And so we have to realize that, you know, it's not always just the Epsteins. You know, it's a lot of people are like, well, it's just people in power, and they'll believe these conspiracy theories that are coming out, you know, where so-and-so is a trafficker, or Wayfair is trafficking people, and yada, yada, yada. Or even like, this is going to get political. We got to make sure to build the wall so that people aren't trafficked over the borders. I'm all for strong borders. But the majority of people that are trafficked through legal ports of entry, which makes it even that more insidious. Strong borders are great, but people are still trafficked no matter how strong your border is. We could have the greatest wall in history. We could have the Great Wall. But people will still come through with falsified documents, and they will be coached on what to say, and they will still come through right under our noses. And so for us, we have to rather than look solely for the red flags of human trafficking, we got to look for vulnerabilities. Because those are the people who are often exploited. It's people who are isolated, the people who are marginalized, the people who are in need, people who are experiencing homelessness, new immigrants, single-parent families, those impacted by incarceration, whether it's the person who's been incarcerated who, when they get out, they go back into the life and we're like, oh, well, see, they're a bad person. Well, they didn't really have any options either. And I'm not saying, I'm saying there's a balance between systemic issues and responsibility issues. And so we have to kind of see that it's very often that the people that I villainize, those are the people that are victimized. The people that you want to keep your kids from fraternizing with, the kids smoking in the parking lot could be abused. But we're like, no, don't hang out with a kid smoking in the parking lot. But we kind of oftentimes, and I say this as someone who's been a pastor, there is this thing in me that defaults to self-protection rather than protecting other people. And I don't know why. But when I trust that God will protect me, and I trust that the gospel is my protection, that he lived for me, died for me, and rose for me to free me, to love him and to love others. When I realize that, I'm compelled to interact with people not knowing how it's going to turn out. And I'm not saying we're not wise. No, we should totally be wise. You know, maybe don't go one-on-one. Maybe trust the Holy Spirit, or as some call it, the uh-oh feeling of, something's wrong here. I don't know. Trust that, because, I mean, there are times God may deliver you from a difficult situation. There are times that God wants you to stay right there so that he can teach and train us. And there are some times that we might not be delivered, but for his glory, you know, the gospel will proceed. And Alan and I were talking about this morning, that when I graduated seminary, and I got a very good education at Southern Seminary. I got a very good education at Southern Seminary. They can pay me if they'd like. I'm available. But I went to West Virginia, and I was campus minister at a historically black college and university as a historically white man. And there were a lot of things that had to be bridged. I had to earn a lot of trust. And I did ministries that I never thought I'd do. I partnered with organizations that I never thought I'd get to partner with. And it was a beautiful time, but I learned a lot. And one of, what was he? I don't know if he classified himself as an apostle or what have you, but the dean of students came up to me and said, hey, I want to talk to you. I said, Bishop Stockton, and I sat down, and he goes, I get that you proclaim the gospel. That's really good. I'm really glad. He's like, but do you demonstrate it? He's like, because proclaiming the gospel is beautiful, but how do you live that out? What does demonstrating it look like? What does justice and mercy look like? And so that started me on a trajectory. Right after that, I would take my students to a passion conference where we were hearing about human trafficking. And I was hearing about how we create a demand for human trafficking and how my own story intersected with that. You know, it's very easy to think your private sins don't have public ramifications, but they do. You know, if we're struggling to look a certain way and we're buying the cheapest clothing to get there, someone had to pay the price. If we're consuming pornography to take the edge off, there's a demand that's being created. In my book, Vulnerable, I go through just the statistics of how much pornography is downloaded and all that. And what that does is, pornography is not only something that's taking the edge off, it's also grooming your own sexual expectations, which can be exploitative. And so I just remember sitting there and being like, I didn't know. It was one of these weird moments where I repented of, and I'd looked at stuff I shouldn't have looked at, and I'd contributed to that, but it's like, I mean, I've talked to pastors who have confessed to me that it started with porn for them, and then they moved into prostitution. They would go to illicit massage parlors, all to take the edge off. And it's just like, and so I bring it up because we've got to kind of sit with it. I sat there, I could tell you where I was sitting, and I just said, God, I'm sorry. And it wasn't that sham repentance, and it wasn't like this glorious prayer that I've prayed before where like I thought that God would answer it because I prayed it a certain way. It was like, God, I'm sorry. And then right after that, I had this thing. It was like the bad pizza feeling. It was like that, you know, it was like, you're supposed to do something about that. And it wasn't coming from a heroic place at all. I was like, I wear cardigans. I'm not going to kick down the door of a brothel. Like, what does it look like for me to fight human trafficking? You know, I'm not law enforcement. I'm not legal. I'm none of those. I'm a pastor of sorts. I was a college pastor. I'm like, what does that mean? And so I responded to that own my own question in, by not doing anything. I ran from it. So I went to West Virginia and ran from this idea for the next year. Ran hard. And it was wild. People were sending me things. They didn't even know anything. They're like, I think you should be involved in this anti-trafficking thing with this organization. And it just kept following me. People would call me and they're like, Raleigh's going to be doing this thing. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm happy. I'm a campus minister. I'm going to be here. And then my job kind of went the way of the buffalo because there were some changes in West Virginia and they were getting rid of collegiate ministry in my denomination. And then one of my best friends from my seminary days, my old roommate, died of cancer, a guy named David. And then I was in a relationship that ended, and it just was this perfect storm where I was like, God, I'm done. So I started raising support, sold everything I owned, moved to New York City to fight human trafficking, even though I didn't know what it meant. And it was while I was there that I was realizing it was my vulnerabilities, God working through my vulnerabilities, that propelled me. So many churches think that we have to know a certain thing or be proficient at certain things to be able to fight trafficking. We start to think, well, we can't rescue. We don't have the people. We don't even have people in our pews who can do a couch to 5K. We definitely don't have people who are going to kick down doors and save people and have a safe home. And we kind of go like to the infinite extent when we think of human trafficking. We're like, I got to do all these things. And so rather than doing something, we fear that we have to do everything and end up doing nothing. When I was in Louisville, I was going to this place called Highland Coffee. They had this drink called the Highland Royale. I loved it.
Highland Coffee is closed, by the way.
I know. I know the world is changing on me. When did it close? A couple years ago?
No, just this past year.
It makes me really sad. They had this drink called the Highland Royale, man. It was like, I think it was a cappuccino, and it had blackberry whipped topping, and it was, I always got it with a cap, so I could just tell people, yeah, I'm drinking black coffee. they're like, do you want a cap? I'm like, yes. Please, I gotta go outside. But I'll never forget walking in there, and this woman's coming out of an alley. It's right there on Bardstown Road, Louisville, right off was it Grinstead?
Right near Grinstead.
And these two young men run out, and then this woman's screaming, and she says, "Help! Help! Help!" She's exasperated. Help! She says, "They stole my purse." Well, I freeze. I froze because I'd never been in that situation. I literally froze. Two other guys were drinking probably black coffee, and they jump over the banister and start chasing him. And then I go back. I go and I get my Highland Royale, and I'm sitting there sipping it, and something in there is like, ah, you got to do something. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I jumped in my car, and I was driving towards the guys. I was going to head them off. But I didn't really have a plan. I think I was going to hit them, which I didn't do, but like it could have been really, really, really bad for me. You know, seminary student mows down two people who supposedly stole purse, allegedly stole purse. But I say that to say, for fear of doing nothing, I did the first thing that came to mind, which was the worst thing. And what I've done with Let My People Go is if human trafficking is the exploitation of vulnerability for commercial gain, then Let My People Go exists to empower the local church to fight human trafficking, big mega issue, by loving those most vulnerable. We don't want the church to do everything. We don't want them to do the first thing. And we definitely don't want them to do nothing. We want to train everyone in the church to do something. So this approach isn't necessarily a programmatic approach. This isn't an approach where we're saying, here's your human trafficking program, plug and play. It's more, how are vulnerable people playing into your congregation? And how do you care for them? If the statistics are, was it, and I sometimes get this one wrong, but 1 in 6 boys are sexually assaulted and 1 in 4 women are sexually assaulted at some point in their life, and you take those statistics and apply them to your congregation, you have a lot of people who've been exploited or abused in your congregation, and oftentimes we don't even know how to talk to them. And I say that as one of you all. You get in there and it's so scary because we're preaching and we're saying things that we mean well. We mean like good things, but we're saying, you know, is God using you? When's the last time you've been used by God? And someone who's experienced trauma is like, I don't want to be used by God. I've been used by every other male figure in my life. You know, and it's little things that we oftentimes, I know I was not, as great as my education was, I was not prepared for trauma. I was not prepared for vulnerability. I was not prepared for my own vulnerability. I felt like I had to be perfect. I wasn't prepared to understand how to operate with a knowledge of my own power. So much of my early ministry was about me proving myself or being good enough or having people report to me so I felt like a powerful person. And when we understand our vulnerability, we have to understand the other side of that is our power. And so how are we operating according to those things? And so, yeah, what Let My People Go does is we work with the local church to help them create an approach that is congregational and collaborative with the gospel as its motive. And so for us, a congregational approach would be one where you identify vulnerability, you can empower those most vulnerable, you can protect them through policies, and you can actually include them. We don't just kind of push them off to the side. I remember talking to one church, and it was a big church in South Florida, and they had a guy working with Mercy Ministries, and he said, hey, we're doing this thing, and we're working with those experiencing homelessness, and we have their own service for them downstairs. And I see why, because sometimes it's hard, and sometimes people don't feel safe. There was this other church in Amish country in Pennsylvania, and I was working with them, and they have this beautiful, ornate church building. Almost looks like a TBN set, like a Trinity Broadcasting set. It's so much gold inlay, and I mean, it was gorgeous though, but it was like real gold, not like spray on, but it was beautiful. Right across the street in their, kind of their fellowship hall, were about 80 to 90 people experiencing homelessness who had their own service. And I asked them a question, and they were part of the same church. And I said, why are they over there and you over here? Like, and they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, could I just guess? Is that okay? And they're like, yeah, sure. I said, maybe they don't feel comfortable, and maybe they feel disempowered, and maybe they don't feel like they fit. And have you ever thought about doing your service with them to kind of experience what they experience on a daily basis? And so much of what Let My People Go does is when we work with churches, we want to help them think through, like, how do we break the us in them? How do we shift it to where your church can not only recognize vulnerable people, but respond to them and include them in the congregation? I'll never forget a conversation I had early on. I think Let My People Go was going to be a t-shirt company or something at the very beginning. And I had this talk with my friend Anna, and Anna had told me how she had been trafficked by a so-called boyfriend, because a lot of trafficking is not from cartels. It's from people you know. It's not stranger danger. Oftentimes it's familial. There's cyclical poverty, but there's also cyclical exploitation. Someone who is exploited at a young age exploits their kid, and you know, it's. I was once upon a time. I was at a sting, a trafficking sting, and two women were arrested, and one was the mother-in-law of the other, and they were there together, and there's a lot of control like that, and that's really what it looks like. But I asked her, I said, you know, she had been trafficked by her boyfriend to do a special art project, which was pornography. She will always say, you never know what the person on the other side of the screen is experiencing behind their smile, behind their joy. You don't know. And she'd been trafficked for that. And I listened to her story, and at the end, I was just so compelled. I was like, what did the local church do for you? And she laughed. She said, for 5 years, I was trafficked, and no one did anything. They didn't know. She's like, to be fair, I didn't know. But so many of us, we don't ask the second question. She said, you know, people come up to me, how you doing? I'm like, I'm fine. But the relationship wasn't strong enough to really sift through that and ask the second question. Well, what do you mean by fine? And I've noticed you're dating this person who's 20 years older than you. Could you tell me more about him? Why doesn't he come to church? You know, it's like, so much of this work is rooted in relationship. It has to be. And so I wrote Vulnerable, which its purpose, and you get a copy of it, but it's the purpose of Vulnerable is to understand that God motivates vulnerable people like you and me to love other vulnerable people by becoming vulnerable for us. And so we see how God uses our, see, I said that word again. God, our own vulnerability plays into how we care for other vulnerable people. The things that we think disqualify us actually qualify us to care for other people. We may not have the same issues, but we sure have issues. And so in this book, I walk through different spheres of vulnerability. I talk to different experts in the field. We talk about human trafficking. I talk about power with Diane Langberg. Talk about church safety with a guy named Boz Chavijan. I talk about the gospel with someone named Michael Horton, and we really tease through this idea of how do we approach it from the scary place? How do we approach it from our lack rather than our surplus, like that place of our limitations? Because so many of us are waiting till we get better, and God's like, no, I called you as you are. Jesus is like, my disciples were fishermen. You know, it's like each of us can reach people. And so in this book, I talk about red flags of human trafficking. You know, here's the things to look for. If someone has multiple hotel keys, or if they have a tattoo with someone's name on it, or a brand, or certain, like, they used to, back in the day, that people used to put barcodes on people's necks, but that's more sensational now. It's like you don't see that as much. But branding, things like that, like, there's all that kind of stuff. And you can look for that. And in the book, it goes very clearly through those. But I tell people, rather than waiting for that, start with who's most vulnerable in your community. And so this book is written for individual Christians to think through how to care for their most vulnerable neighbors. But this right here is my new book. It's the Let My People Go Handbook. And it's a free download, and you can also get it on Amazon. But there, we talk about how the church can do this. And this is where I'll ask you all, like, and Todd's church may be a little different here, because I know they've been doing this work a long time, but does your church know who's most vulnerable in your community? And if so, how do you know?
My wife works for Clarity Solutions, which is our crisis pregnancy center here in town. And it's incredible to me how many women come through Clarity that they either expect or know 100% have been trafficked or abused. Like sometimes I just want to, like, Hannah will text me and she'll be like, you won't believe like what's going on. And you just want to like drop down there and just beat the crap out of this boyfriend that's just like there forcing, you know, wanting her, this, his girlfriend to get an abortion because, you know, he got her pregnant and he doesn't want to deal with it. And a lot of these people are poor, impoverished. There's a, somebody else might know, there's like a camp of homeless people around here. And like these women who are like pregnant are like riding on a bicycle to Clarity to get an ultrasound to confirm their pregnancy. One woman was so far, she was like 27 weeks along and was just now realizing that like something was different about her body. And so her boyfriend wants her to get an abortion. She goes to Clarity because their services are free. But they don't offer abortions there, but they offer ultrasounds and pregnancy tests, and then they try to share the gospel and, you know, different options other than abortion. And like, dude, what's your deal? Like, why are you being such a butthole to this girl? You know, I mean, it's really opened my eyes just to like, here in E-Town, where you wouldn't think much is going on, there's trafficking. You know, there's people being abused and enslaved, and I don't think that's dramatic to use that word, you know.
Yeah, and you see a little of it when you have organizations that you're connected with,
mm-hmm.
that are seeing it. Absolutely. Any of the rest of you all? Thank you.
I think for us in our neighborhood, it was somewhat obvious because, you know, we're in a refugee community. Most of us live there, and so, you know, it's been a resettlement kind of focal point for 35 years now, and so, you know, we could be more stupid because it was just so obvious, and, you know, just the vulnerability that's there. And I don't know that even after all these years of being there and in the middle of it, I don't know that we've fully put together the pieces of potentially the connection between potential trafficking and the refugee status. You know, I mean, we know that that makes them for sure more vulnerable, not always seeing that next piece of it. But yet, I mean, our community was kind of shook up probably, I guess it's been maybe 6 years ago, and we found out that in one of the newer neighborhoods that had been built out, these really nice houses, you know, probably 250 and all of that, that one of the Chinese restaurants closed down, and it turned out that these people were bringing in folks. They had them pent up in the basement, and they were working, you know, 16-hour shifts at the restaurant. And they would basically, you know, load them up in a van, take them from the house to the restaurant. They'd work, take them back, put them back in the basement. And it had been going on apparently for years, and everybody was oblivious. So, and it was, the restaurant was literally right down the street from my house. So.
And that story is sadly common in a lot of communities where a restaurant may be the entry point.
Yeah.
People could be trafficked for sex, labor, what have you, but they get a job there, and then you're like, why? It's a family restaurant, but why are there so many cousins, you know? It's like, why are people?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
How about your church? Have you all been able to figure that out? Like,
there hasn't really been much focus on that, I don't think. Specifically, no. I can't think of anything, but.
Well, and it's like, I appreciate that because I feel like a lot of churches, when we think of who's most vulnerable, and Alan, I mean, about your church, like, has your church been able to figure that as well before I dive into the next thing?
Yeah, to a degree. The church where I'm a member, of course, I'm out and about and hardly there.
Yeah.
But I would say that in South Kentucky, the prevailing attitude is it just does not happen mm-hmm. here. It's not going on here. That's a Louisville problem. That's a Nashville problem. A Knoxville problem, maybe.
Yeah, it's a sporting event problem. Yeah. It's not. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I've always heard the Derby is the
yeah
the world capital of trafficking when it's going on.
And you're gonna hear everyone's gonna say, our state is the greatest place per capita for human trafficking. This event's the biggest. I think just to remember, wherever you have vulnerable people, you're going to have people who want to exploit them.
Yeah.
And even in small towns, you know, even if you have vulnerability, you're going to have it, because so much of what we see on the news, they'll say the Super Bowl, the Derby, the World Cup. Yes, because there's a lot of people. But it's also happening literally every day. And so when we just focus on one thing, we miss it. And
Raleigh, I would say a godsend to the church where my membership is was, you know, the Lord brought a home for ladies that are pushing through addictions.
Ooh.
I mean, just right on the same block where the church is, in very easy walking distance. And it's been beautiful to see how the church has adopted that as a ministry. And so now there's been an influx of those ladies, but a lot of those ladies reach for Christ and baptized and becoming disciples. But their stories, as they have, you know, mixed and blended with the congregation, and it's beautiful there, because it's not what you described earlier. They don't have their own thing, and then the rest of the church has its thing. They are blending. But their stories,
so beautiful.
Their stories have really opened the eyes of a lot of our people.
That's so beautiful. And that's really what you just said. I'm so glad you said it, because as I kind of land the plane, that is the heart of Vulnerable. That's the heart of the Let My People Go handbook. That's the heart of Let My People Go. It's to see a church where people feel safe to be. I was at a, I'll never forget, I was at a church, and it was a big church. The pastor was an author. He was a well-known guy and super cool. Like, I was like, man, this guy gets it, you know? And I'll never forget being in a church, and there was a guy experiencing homelessness who walked into the church, and he sat down, and he was worshiping his own way. You know, he hadn't been shaped by the church yet. You know, he hadn't dove into the church culture. He was just experiencing something.
Yeah.
And two deacons came and escorted him out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And I talked to the pastor, and I said, or talked to one of the church leaders. I said, if this is what happened, then we're going to have a conversation. And that church is now under new leadership, and the pastor, you know, he kind of mentored me a little bit while I was starting Let My People Go, and he was just like, you know, his thing is he wants the church to be a safe place for everyone. And this church actually, you know, once upon a time, you know, they're a celebrity pastor. I think before celebrity pastors were a thing, he had his own TV show, and they had put these blue benches all over the property, and they're like, you know why we put the blue benches out? I'm like, no. And they're like, because if you were experiencing homelessness or something, the deacons would take you there and have you sit down until the service was over, then they would meet your need. And I think the church was meaning well. I don't think they were trying to be whatever, but I think they forgot that the main need of these people is not food. You can get food anywhere. There are so many services in every community I've seen. And generally, people experiencing homelessness, they run in a crew, they know where to go. They know where to go to get showers, they know where to go to get socks, they know where to go to get food. They know who's open on what days, where they can get a hot meal. They know all that. But they also want community. And I think sometimes we are trying to be helpful, and we actually hurt the very people that are coming in, because we're like, no, your need is this. And so the reason I ask you, do you know who's most vulnerable, is because oftentimes we don't. And so the handbook, you know, is basically the accompaniment to this book, but it's for churches. And we basically walk through churches and help them think through this systematic approach where, like, my mentor at that church in South Florida was like, Raleigh, I'm a busy person trying to keep this thing afloat, very busy. How can you take things off my plate rather than put things on? And it really stuck with me. So what we do in this handbook, you'll see, is the whole goal is first, create a team. We call it a justice and mercy team. That team is going to do a community needs assessment. They're going to talk to local stakeholders in the community, because we can assume we know what's happening, but we may not. So they talk to local law enforcement, social services, local nonprofits, school board, local stores. Who is most vulnerable from your estimation? Who have you worked with in the past? Have churches worked with you? What are the gaps you're seeing in the community? Who in the community is crushing it? Who is not in your estimation? What are the assets here? What are the needs here? How have you partnered with churches? So the team goes out and they all do different interviews. And then they come together and they're like, okay, I talked to this group and they said single parents. This group said single new immigrants. This group said, you know, and as they're talking, something's gonna bubble up to the top. And it might be single parents of immigrant families in your community. It could be those experiencing homelessness. It could be youth in the LGBTQ community, because they're one of the most targeted groups in the country. And churches often don't know how to respond. And the Bible gave us a very clear approach, like whether you agree or disagree, we're called to love and be a safe place for vulnerable people. And I got to have that conversation a lot in New York, where I'm like, you know, we might land somewhere different here theologically. By we might, I'm just being very charitable. I know we do. But I was like, I still believe that the church is called to love people that are different than us, the people that it's very easy for us to villainize. And when you see those people as people who could be exploited, it kind of changes it for me. It's like, now I really am like, kind of getting over those fears of self-protection and saying, okay, like, how do I love boldly here? And so you do the community needs assessment, something bubbles to the top, then that team shares with the pastoral staff, here's the need we saw. We need to create a vulnerability response plan. Here are two organizations that are working with the very group that we identified. Let's partner with them specifically. Here are some suggestions on how you can preach 8 to 12 times. It might not be a full sermon, but at least touch on our neighbors in your sermons. Here's a way where if someone who's vulnerable has come to know Christ and they're coming up, here's a safe way for us to introduce them to the congregation if they want to share their story, so that we don't end up re-triggering or exploiting them. Here's how we don't create a new program, but we want to see people who are vulnerable have the same opportunities as us. We want to see people made deacons. We want to see, you know, maybe they become a pastor. Maybe if someone's like an ex-convict or what have you, maybe we help them start a business. You know, there are things that we can do, but we want to include them in our congregation. The handbook also helps you think through policies. What policies do we have in place to protect vulnerable people? And so at the end of the day, the handbook's not exhaustive, but it'll start a conversation, and that's really what we want. So you can download that on our website, lmpg.org. I would love to come and spend more time with you at your churches, but at the end of the day, this handbook is probably the most practical thing I've ever written in my entire life. It's really, I mean, there's theology to it too, but it's, here's what you do. And it kind of, it'll give you a roadmap. And you may not do everything in it, but it'll give you a guide. And it answers the question of, but what do I do? How do I respond to human trafficking? How do I respond to my vulnerable neighbors? And so as you probably picked up in this conversation, yeah, it's about trafficking, But it's more about your vulnerable people who are already there. So it, this approach, you could take human trafficking out of it and it would still guide you to your vulnerable neighbors. And that's really, that's what I'm about. That's what the organization's about. That's what the books are about. But that said, it's time. If you have any questions, I'd love to field them. But I'd love for you to check it out and let me know how we can help you.